Good evening, everyone. You're in the right place at the right time. This is Coast to Coast AM, blasting out of the Mojave Desert like a Scirocco, blazing across the land, slamming into your radio like a supercharged nanoparticle of unobtainium. Greetings from the boldest, bawdiest, most outrageous city in the world, the planetary capital of sun, fun, sin, sex, and secrets, my not-so-humble hometown, Las Vegas, Nevada. My name is George Knapp, your occasional host, designated driver of the airwaves, and moderator of tonight's upcoming cacophonous cavalcade of conversation. Happy to be back with you and hoping your February is going well. It's been in the 80s here in the desert this week. 80s. Winter lasted all of about, 2 weeks or so. If you're still buried in snow somewhere, you have my sympathies. Las Vegas has been sort of the center of the political universe for the past couple of weeks. We had the Democratic presidential caucus this weekend, and the Republicans are up next. Their caucus is set to happen later this week, which means that every moment on every TV station, every time you turn it on, every cable channel, every network affiliate, every radio station is filled with candidate messages, most of them about what slime balls the other candidates are. Our mailboxes are filled daily with attacks. The phone rings all hours of the day and night with calls from campaigns or calls from pollsters or calls from campaigns pretending to be pollsters or the other way around. It's a wonder to behold. Coming to a state near you, I would presume, unless you're Iowa or South Carolina or New Hampshire, I think it's the most interesting presidential election of my life. Because of the unpredictability. I mean, whatever the experts have said or predicted, whatever the parties, Democrats or the Republicans, the establishment have tried to do, the public has proven them to be wrong so far. It's been highly entertaining so far, I would say. And now that the fields have narrowed, I think the fun quotient is going to start dropping and the nastiness factor will start rising because it's kind of crunch time from here on out. A greetings to all of our listeners who attended the UFO Congress in Arizona this past week. Big turnout, from what I was told, as usual, for this event. Biggest UFO conference in the world. Perhaps the highlight of the week, well, undoubtedly the highlight of the week, was the interview of the legendary Dr. Jacques Vallée by Lee Spiegel of the Huntington Press. I've not seen this exchange yet, but I'm going to order a copy of the DVD. Our colleague Alejandro Rojas of Open Minds, that's the organization which sponsors and organizes this conference every year, said that for the attendees, it was, quote, wonderful to have this rare opportunity to see Jacques Vallée in person. In case you don't know it, Dr. Vallée used to be a regular at these conferences, but sort of gave up on it. It became kind of a waste of his time to say the same stuff over and over again, so he stopped going to these things. Very rare that he shows up at one and speaks, and he opened himself up to questions from not only Lee Spiegel, but from the audience, and I guess it went over really well. Covered some great stories of accounts of strange occupancies in ancient times that are mentioned in his latest book, Wonders in the Sky. And as Alejandro said, it's obvious he's still very passionate about the study of anomalous phenomenon. And as we know from our interviews on this program, Dr. Vallée's study of this stuff extends far beyond the mystery about flying saucers. His view is that this UFO mystery is part of something much larger and grander in scope and maybe a lot weirder than mere lights and craft in the sky. Also, a shout out to our recent guest on this program, Jeremy Corbell, who was here last month to help promote the conference and his films, one of which was awarded an EBE award. That's the alien-shaped statuette, kind of the ET version of an Oscar, for Jeremy's short film about the Bob Lazar story. Sorry I wasn't able to attend the conference, but I hope to get back there next year. We have what I think will be an invigorating program for you tonight. You remember the great sci-fi movie Minority Report? I think I remember reading it was based on a short story by the late Philip K. Dick. In the movie, Tom Cruise plays a cop who arrests people before they commit crimes. He's aided by a team of what they call in the movie precogs. Precognitives, psychics, who predict when somebody is plotting to murder someone else. And that idea might seem kind of far-fetched, but not in the halls of the Pentagon. Our military has been working on its own precog capability for almost 25 years now. It wants to know what we're going to do before we do it. Presumably so it can predict when bad guys will do bad things. But the thing is, all that so-called harmless metadata that's being collected and compiled in gigantic supercomputers, including that big one in Utah, all that harmless data about you and me, our phone calls, our emails, goes into these computers, never comes out, can help predict what you, the American citizen, are thinking, planning, doing, what your proclivities are, what your political preferences are, when you might step out of line. It doesn't take too much imagination to envision a scenario where that kind of capability could be misused or applied to some very dark scenarios. Tonight, in the second half of this program, an international security consultant, author, and investigative journalist, Dr. Nafees Ahmed, will be here to tell us how far along the U.S. government is in the development of a pre-COG program and just what it might be used for. Dr. Ahmed has also written some controversial pieces about 9/11, some pretty grim assessments about what is happening with the global economy and ecosystem. I think it's very compelling stuff, and I know it lands right in the middle of our wheelhouse here on Coast to Coast. Before that, though, the bloody tale of the largest heist in American history, at least in which the loot was never recovered, the Lufthansa heist of 1978. If you've seen the movie Goodfellas, you know the name Henry Hill. He was played by Ray Liotta in that Martin Scorsese film. Terrific movie, based on a real incident, true life characters, deadly organized crime figures who somehow figured out how to steal almost $6 million in cash and jewelry from a New York airport. And that's a pretty big haul, but it's the equivalent of about $21 million today. So that was one big score for those mob guys. A lot of people were murdered to keep the masterminds safe. Henry Hill, as you probably know, became a government witness and turned on his former comrades because they planned to kill him next. Hill died in 2012, but before he departed, he collaborated on a terrific book that went far beyond the story told in Goodfellas. His co-author, Daniel Simone, joins me in a couple of minutes to tell the real-life story behind the mobster heist, the biggest in American history, and how they did it, and more importantly, where all that money may have gone. On the Coast to Coast website tonight, some items of interest. Webmaster Lex and I have collected our usual assortment of items and oddities culled from the world's media over the last week or so. Have you wondered, as I have, what the X-37B spy plane is doing up there? What's this mysterious plane's mission? We've got a story on it. Also, have you seen the report posted by Lee Spiegel for Huffington Post? I mentioned him a couple of minutes ago. He interviews former astronauts who tell a chilling story about this strange music they heard while they were on the other side of the moon. That spot, presumably out of earshot, out of satellite view of the Earth. They shouldn't be able to get any radio signals from Earth. So what the heck were they hearing? Also, an intriguing story about a future guest on Coast to Coast, Paul Davids. He's a film director and producer who's exploring whether a pioneer in sci-fi who died recently at the age of 92, is now communicating with us from the other side. Pretty interesting piece. And another report, I think, that'll make you angry about how war dogs are disposed of once their service is done. Also on the website, while you're there, checking out Knapp's News, take a look at how to become a Coast Insider. It's still a great deal. Pennies a day gives you access to a vast catalog, a library of Coast programs. You can listen anytime you want, as often as you want, on any device. Also, information there about George Norrie's Beyond Belief television show. It's a kind of a TV version of the Coast show, and you can subscribe to it in case it's not carried on the airwaves or the cable system where you live. Time now to take our first break. Pour that cup of joe, jump into those jammies and slippers, plop yourself down in that Barca lounger and turn up the radio, because we're ready to rumble here, back in a moment with the true story of the Lufthansa heist. I'm George Knapp, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast to Coast. You know, I thought I knew the story of the Lufthansa heist pretty well. The movie, of course, that I mentioned, Goodfellas, great Martin Scorsese film. I had read the book Wise Guy, which was sort of the first book that was written about Henry Hill. That was the basis of that movie. I even got to meet Henry Hill twice. He in the later part of his life. He had been in and out of Las Vegas. He was part of the small group of mob guys who'd give public presentations, a far cry from the days when he was sort of on the run, laying low in the witness protection program. But I learned a heck of a lot by reading this new book, The Lufthansa Heist, co-written by Henry Hill and Daniel Simone. It's a terrific, it's a page-turner, and Daniel, welcome to the program.
My pleasure to be with you, George.
Oh, man, it was just a, I couldn't put this thing down. It's got so much stuff in it that I'd never seen before. I'm curious how you got hooked up with Henry Hill and why you would tackle this book when, you know, there already been a best-selling book that Nick Pileggi had written, why you would take this on. But did you feel that the true story had not yet been told?
Well, first of all, it's very flattering, your comments, how you enjoyed the book. I thank you so much. And to be more direct with your question, the story began immediately after the robbery took place in 1978. I lived in the vicinities of Kennedy Airport during that period. And the story was in the media was simply fascinating. It sounded as if it was scripted in Hollywood. And of course, it remained in the headlines for the following 12 to 14 months. And you simply could not get away from Lufthansa. If you turned on a TV or radio or read a newspaper, it was nothing but Lufthansa, Lufthansa, Lufthansa. Coincidentally, at that same period, I was into a relationship with a Lufthansa stewardess, which in essence brought me closer to this topic. And so fascinated I was that I at that time resolved that someday I would find the opportunity to write a book about this, and that's how it began.
I want to start sort of at the end because, you know, people are sitting at home, they're wondering, well, why are we talking about this case? Well, it's still making news. This is just 3 months ago. There was this huge high-profile trial in New York of a guy named Vincent Acero that I'd never heard of him before. Suddenly he's portrayed as sort of the key figure in the whole thing. And I was thinking, why are they going after this guy now? You must have been thinking the same thing.
Well, the first time I heard the news, the breaking news that Vincent Acero had been arrested and charged as one of the masterminds of the Lufthansa robbery, I was absolutely dumbfounded. I was startled. I knew of Vincent Acero. He was, in fact, a reputed criminal. But pursuant to my findings, he had nothing at all to do with the Lufthansa robbery. And 10 minutes after the breaking news that morning, I received a call from one of the lead FBI agents who handled the investigation. And very candidly, he asked me, he said, do you know anything about this? Is there something about this that I don't know about? I said, you know, and interestingly, his name is Ed. I said, interestingly, I was about to post, you know, the same question to you. And he said, candidly, he said to me, no, I know absolutely nothing about it. And that's how it began. And of course, the story stayed in the media until the trial began, and that was this past November of 2015.
I can't imagine how much time the U.S. Attorney's Office put into this case. He was behind bars for 2 years, and they must have worked on it longer than that, trying to put the guy away. And then I read the New York Times stories that said when the jury announced its verdict, you could have heard a pin drop, that everyone was shocked.
Well, those who were shocked were the government people, but certain individuals, as myself, for example, I did attend the trial. I was not at all surprised. In fact, I had been professing to various members of the media throughout the trial that what you are hearing inside that courtroom is not really what happened, but no one really took me seriously. And then, of course, after the acquittal, I became an instant prophet. But going back to what you just mentioned, indeed, the government began working on this case back in 2008, when the informant decided to cooperate with the FBI. And not only that, they spent so many years on this case, but in my estimation, the prosecutors must have squandered probably $4 to $5 million of taxpayers' money. While knowing that their week was extremely, extremely weak at best.
Well, we'll come back to that later in the program. Let's talk about Henry Hill. How is it you became, from just based on comments that you make at different points of the book, seems like you like the guy. I mentioned in the introduction, I've met him a couple of times. By the time I had seen him late in life, he was obviously charming and a smooth talker, but he was kind of a degenerate. I mean, most people would say, but I think I get the sense that you guys kind of hit it off.
We did. We met by coincidence at a fundraiser. It was not a meeting that had been arranged. It was perchance. And as soon as I recognized him, I approached him, introduced myself, and I proposed to write a book about the Lufthansa robbery. And unhesitantly, Henry extended his hand for a handshake, and we struck a deal right there and then.
Was there something that he felt had never been told, some part of it that he wanted out there? That was not included in the movie or in Pileggi's book?
For various reasons, I would estimate that 70% of the content of my book are facts and revelations that have never before been revealed. Henry opened up to me primarily because we were now dealing with this project 35 years after the actual robbery, whereas when he collaborated with Nick Pileggi in his first book, the topic was still rather fresh. It was still rather contemporary at that time. And I'm assuming that Henry had held back for certain reasons that may have been to his advantage and to the advantage of some other individuals who at that point in time might have still been alive.
So describe for our audience, those who might not be familiar with the book or the movie, or those who were, fill in the blanks about Henry Hill, what kind of guy he was, what he had done. You point out in the book a couple of times that at least for a while there, he had said he didn't resort to violence. He wasn't a thug and didn't shoot people, though there are conflicting versions of that. But just give us paint us a picture about who he was.
Well, he was a degenerate, no doubt. As a matter of fact, he was a certified degenerate, no question about it. But he was an affable chap, garrulous, charming, loved to tell stories about his days of glories, loved to drink. He called it social drinking, but of course it was beyond that. To the best of my findings, Henry was not a violent individual. His temperament did not tend to the violence. In fact, he stressed emphatically that he spent many, many, many days separating his associates from killing one another. In the end, I think that he was a criminal, but never intended to hurt those who would suffer from his pilfering or his thefts or his criminalities in general.
He was drawn to a life of crime starting from an early age because he saw these mob guys in the neighborhood, and they were driving the nicest cars, had a lot of money to flash around, tipped, over-tipped, and he liked that right off the bat, right?
Well, yes, indeed, George. Like most of us Americans, Henry was fascinated. He was enamored with the apparent or lifestyle of what was seemingly a very, very glamorous way of living. Of course, the influences were right across the street from his home. That was the taxi stand company where several reputed gangsters congregated from morning till night. It was too tempting. And Henry, of course, fascinated by this aura that these individuals portrayed, became an instant follower and gave up school and started. And instead of going to his public school, he turned to the school of the streets.
And he started doing running errands for him, making some money. As a youngster, and he got pinched at an early age, right?
Yes, he did, and that was the official initiation of Henry having been inducted inside the circles of that element.
And he could never be a made member because of blood.
Indeed, yes, he was not a full-blooded Italian, but because he was charming and accommodating, and soon enough he learned to become what they call an earner. The mafia hierarchy welcomed him with open arms.
We're talking with Daniel Simone, a co-author with Henry Hill of the new book, The Lufthansa Heist, a great read. When we come back, we're going to introduce some of the other characters, Jimmy the Gent and Tommy DeSimone, some of the guys names you might know from the movie or the books. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. We're talking with Daniel Simone, co-author with Henry Hill of The Lufthansa Heist, behind the $6 million cash haul that shook the world. In addition to Henry Hill, the other characters of note, Jimmy the Gent, Burke, Tommy DeSimone, Big Pauly, John Gotti plays a role in this story. We're going to hear that and more from my guest, Daniel Simone, right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast to Coast. We're talking with Daniel Simone about the Lufthansa heist, Henry Hill, and another cast of characters. Daniel, before the break, you mentioned that Henry developed a reputation as an earner. How did he earn? What did he do?
Well, he was proficient at scheming all sorts of frauds, for example, rigged card games, hijacking trucks from Kennedy Airport with precious cargo, extortion in the sense that he would demand payments, weekly payments from local storekeepers and merchants in exchange for protection from whom he would never really clarify, but nonetheless he was able to extort in that sense. And of course other assortments of criminalities that were rather ingeniously designed and created. And all combined, Henry soon gained the reputation of being what they called an earner. And this is the reason why he was embraced by certain mafia members. And Jimmy the Gent Burke, as you mentioned earlier, was basically Henry Hill's supervisor. Jimmy the Gent Burke, an Irishman, also could not be full-fledged mafia member. But Jimmy the Gent Burke, a very, very astute criminal, was also a great earner. And he more or less assembled his own group of earners, such as Henry Hill, and that became known as the Robert's Lounge gang. Robert's Lounge was a seedy bar that Jimmy Burke secretly owned in the neighborhood. And of course, the local detectives who had always their radar on this bar, because all of Jimmy Burke's felons congregated, termed it the Robert Lounge gang.
So Jimmy Burke sort of had his own crew. And although they were wise guys, they were not mafia guys. I mean, they were somewhat associated with the mafia boss who had them under his umbrella, but they were never members. They could never be made members, but they still were on the fringes of an organized crime group.
Yes, they were. And as you well said, they were under Jimmy Burke's umbrella. And they were part of his crew, but no, they were not members of the mafia, nor could they communicate directly with any so-called made men of the Lucchese crime family.
So it was Big Pauly. He's the Lucchese. It's the Lucchese family that he was associated with. He was kind of the guy they reported to unofficially?
Yes, Paul Vario, known as Big Pauly, was one of the capo regimes of the Lucchese family, a very, very powerful individual within his own circles. And he was the sponsor of Jimmy Burke as an associate of the mafia. And of course, Henry Hill, whom Paul Vario had known since he was 12, 13 years of age, had taken a liking to him as a young boy, then as a teenager, and of course, ultimately as an adult, who became a valued member of the crew.
And as in the movie, you know, at a young age, Henry Hill gets pinched for some crime. He does some time, but he doesn't snitch. He doesn't rat anybody out. That, at a young age, gives him a leg up. They trust him a little bit, so he's sort of the gang, part of the gang.
That was when Henry Hill gained the respect and the esteem, and yes, he became part of the gang.
And they operate sort of with sort of the protection of Big Pauly, but they're not really part of his gang. Could they do work? Were they freelancers? Could they work for other crime families, or just strictly for him?
Theoretically, yes, they could. At times, they did. But if they did work or collaborate with a faction of another family, or even a member of another family, the procedure was that they always had to pay tribute to Paul Vario. And Paul Vario was, in fact, their protector in any way he could, protecting them from the law in the event they got into trouble, because Paul Vario had some very strong ties and connections to many politicians and judges. And also, if another family would try to outmuscle Jimmy Burke's crew, Paul Vario was always there to provide the cavalry.
Tommy DeSimone in the movie, the Goodfellas movie, he's played by Joe Pesci, a little guy, but Tommy DeSimone in real life, as you described him, was a big guy.
Yes, he was actually. He had the build of a heavyweight boxer, and he certainly could handle himself extremely, extremely well. And he was very, very hard-headed. And Tommy was not an earner, but Tommy was provided the muscle when it was needed.
He was a killer, though.
He was a psychopathic killer. He would kill for no particular reason. If case in point, he was known to, and on several occasions, when he shot bystanders, strangers, because he was simply adjusting or recalibrating the sight of his pistol or his revolver.
Okay, John Gotti makes an appearance and plays an important role in the story you tell in the Lufthansa heist. He's another family altogether, and he's still an up-and-comer at that point. He's not a boss, right?
No, he's not a boss, but he was a made man, an official member of the Gambino family, and he had very, very strong ties and connections with Jimmy Burke, and most frequently they collaborated on several heists, airport truck hijackings, and any sort of pilfering. And Henry Hill also became friendly with John Gotti, and John Gotti provided certain aspects of the Lufthansa robbery. For case in point, he provided the warehouse where the team of gunmen met immediately after the robbery, and transferred the packets of the bundles of money from the getaway van to a different vehicle. And John Gotti also sanctioned the Lufthansa robbery because his family, the Gambino crime family, also had their stakes deeply rooted into Kennedy Airport, and any criminalities that occurred there, there was an understanding that Jimmy Burke would pay tribute to John Gotti as well.
Let's go back to Henry for a second. You talked about him being an earner. A lot of what the movie, the Goodfellas movie, described as his involvement in the drug trade, and you get into that as well in the Lufthansa heist about him dealing in drugs. He must have made a ton of money, but it was forbidden for any of Big Pauly's crew to be involved in drugs, at least officially. That would be the policy, because I guess they figured somebody in drugs would be more likely to roll over.
Well, yes, because the narcotics charge carried a very, very stiff, long sentences, and needless to say, anyone, as Paul Vario often preached, anyone facing such dire straits and facing a lifetime of incarceration would testify, as Paul Vario would say, even against his own mother.
Henry Hill must have made millions of dollars in the drug trade. He kicked up a piece of it to Paul Vario. Paul, at some level, Big Paulie must have known what was going on, just didn't ask.
He did. He did know what was going on. And, of course, when Henry would deliver to him that envelope full of money, Paul Vario would more or less change the subject and be satisfied with whatever explanations or lies Henry would tell him as to how he made that money.
You know, in addition to dealing in drugs, cocaine and heroin, and who knows what else, both Henry Hill and Jimmy Burke and who knows who else in their crew were big customers. I mean, they were their own best customers. They used a lot of this stuff themselves. It's hard to imagine how they could do that kind of drugs and be cogent enough to not get nabbed.
Well, that's a good point, and they did get nabbed because Henry became careless. He became a vagrant. He simply could no longer function with any reasonable sensibility, and his carelessness caused his demise. And at that point, that was the beginning of the end. And it had not been for the fact that he did decide to enlist in the Federal Witness Protection Program, who knows what might have happened. He might have either been murdered as a result of the Lufthansa robbery, or perhaps he might have died in prison.
Well, we'll get to that for sure. I want to talk a little bit about your relationship with Henry. You had said, you know, you acknowledged that he was a degenerate, but it sounds like you guys were friends. Were you able to travel around freely with him as you worked on this project? Could he visit his old haunts, or did he have to worry about somebody taking a shot at him even at the end of his life?
Was even at that, Henry was careless. But of course, he was reasonably confident that anyone who may have posed a threat was either imprisoned or had already died. But he did stay out of Brooklyn in particular, I must add. And he was, by the time I met him, he had already mellowed. He was already on an age, approximately 67 or 68 years old, by the time I actually got into it with him. So there was a certain mellowness that had subdued him. He wasn't as, boisterous as he may have been in his younger years, but he was also difficult to deal with because he provided many inconsistencies. At times, his memory was vague, hazy, and it was a trip working with him.
Yeah, I mentioned in the introduction that I had met him twice here in Las Vegas. He would pal around with these other guys who had been in the Witness Protection Program who are now out in the open. They would have public events. They would do, like, book signings and stuff, and sometimes some of the FBI guys who had worked their cases were with him.
Yes. In fact, the two FBI agents who led the Lufthansa investigation remained friendly with Henry. They kept in touch, and Henry introduced me to them, and of course they provided me with invaluable information. They were very, very generous with whatever they possibly could convey to me that they knew. In fact, one of them wrote the foreword in my book, and the second wrote the epilogue.
Yeah, I thought it was fascinating and stuff. We'll come back to that part of the story because the conflicts within law enforcement is a part of the story that I had never heard before, and it's maybe the most surprising part of the book. Let's talk about the heist itself and the lead up to the heist. The airport, you describe in the beginning of the book that Henry saw Kennedy Airport as sort of like his bank. When he needed money, he went to the airport.
Yes, they went. They all went to the airport, and they pilfered, they stole whatever they could at any one particular day and time. And yes, and in fact, the airport was Henry Hill and Jimmy Burke's ATM machine, if you will.
Like what? They stole. I mean, how? It's hard to imagine they could steal so much over so long a period of time without somebody putting a stop to it.
Well, they had a lot of assistance. First of all, the local police and the Port of New York Port of Authority police officers were very, very corrupt. They turned their eye to whatever illicit activities were going on. And of course, they would accept bribes and graft. But also, the airline's cargo employees were also degenerate gamblers. They were immoral, and they assisted in the truck hijackings and the robberies that took place at the various cargo terminals.
Yeah, they would give them information. Hey, this is coming in. A shipment of X, Y, or Z is coming in, and in exchange for either a piece of the action or getting a break on what they already owed to loan sharks or bookies or something like that, right?
Yes, even to the extent that many truck drivers who drove these trucks that transported valuables would intentionally leave the trucks unattended at a diner or at a truck stop to facilitate Henry or his associates to easily be able to jump into the truck and take off with it.
So prior to the Lufthansa heist, they had another really big score, the Air France thing. Henry Hill got a tip about it. Tell that story.
Well, that is exactly what caused Henry Hill to rose to prominence in that society that he so much loved. Yes, they actually walked in into the high value vault at the Air France cargo terminal and very easily walked out with satchels of cash and jewels that all combined totaled almost $500,000. Which translated to today's present value dollar would probably amount to $5 to $6 million.
Man, that's amazing. So how much did Henry Hill get out of that, do you think?
Henry Hill got probably 20 to 25% of that haul, and that more or less set him straight, sure-footed financially. And then he invested some of that money in a restaurant in Queens, and the rest, just happened on a day-by-day basis.
The story you tell about him taking over this restaurant's a pretty good one. It was somebody who also was a degenerate gambler who was into loan sharks for a bunch of money. And he pleaded with Henry to take over his joint, right?
Yes, he did, and Henry did take over, and the arrangement was that Henry would assume the loan shark debts that the owner of the restaurant was fumbling with, floundering in, and of course, with Paul Vario's intervention, the loan sharks were basically told to simply forget about whatever outstanding loans the restaurant owner might have had, and Henry got away without paying anything for the back to the whatever was owed to the loan sharks.
Jumping ahead a little bit, though, you tell the story later when Henry gets in trouble. He still owns this place. He's in danger of losing it because he's going to prison. He ends up, it gets padlocked. He breaks the locks, goes in and loots the place and has a big party before it's taken over by somebody else.
That is precisely what he did. It's rather comedic how it happened. but once Henry knew that he was going to prison, he ransacked the restaurant of anything that was left of value, and that was his final blow before he turned himself in and began his prison sentence along with Jimmy Burke.
You would think that after the Air France heist, after years of pilferage and thievery at the airport, after a score that big, that all the airlines would take steps to be a little more careful. Certainly, I guess the Lufthansa airline did try to take steps. They thought they were impregnable, I guess, and that was part of their downfall, right?
Yes, it is. But what's interesting to note is that the airlines who were careless and not adequately secured were primarily the European airlines, Air France, the Lufthansa, Alitalia, KLM. And the reason, in my opinion, The reason why the foreign airlines, the European airlines, were far more lackadaisical in the sense of security was at that time because they simply were too arrogant in believing that they could be had so easily by Americans.
Yeah, they're really cocky about the whole thing.
They were. They were very cocky about it. In fact, when Lufthansa, when the Lufthansa administrators telephoned their counterparts in Germany announcing that they had been robbed, they were admonished. They were called degenerate drunks, drunkards, and hellraisers who don't pay attention to business, meaning that had they, the German managers, had they been in control of the New York cargo building,
they would have stopped it.
The robbery would not have happened.
We're talking with Daniel Simone. When we come back, we get into the specifics about the Lufthansa heist. Why was so much money sitting around in one little warehouse?